shape action. To remain usable, they need to be cared for. To a large extent, I believe that caring for one another, including the spiritual care we've been talking about at this gathering, depends on caring for words. George Orwell in 1946 and George Steiner in 1959 warned readers about how language could lose its resiliency and utility and beauty when it was co-opted to serve commercial and political agendas. Their arguments are still widely cited, so I'd like to quote them briefly here. Actually, Orwell's essay, Politics in the English Language, used to be standard fare. Some of you probably read it in college. I did. Orwell claims this: modern English, especially written English, is full of bad habits which spread by imitation and which can be avoided if one is willing to take the necessary trouble. If one gets rid of these habits, one can think more clearly. And to think clearly is as necessary a first step toward political regeneration, so that the fight against bad English is not frivolous and is not the exclusive concern of professional writers. And I want to say here what he means by bad English isn't incorrect English or even street English. It's sloppy, imprecise English that dulls the instruments of meaning. This description, like Orwell's ominous version of Newspeak, if you remember that as the kind of political discourse in his prophetic novel 1984, as a form of mind control, may have an unsettling ring of familiarity. In a similar vein, but more bleakly, George Steiner reflects on what actually happened to the German language under Hitler's Third Reich. How many of you are familiar with George Steiner? He's a brilliant writer, I think, many, many books. He speaks 15 languages. He's, I guess, for lack of a better term, a culture critic. He's a Jewish writer who has hovered around Christian culture with great respect and curiosity and intelligence for many years. He wrote a preface to the English Bible and a preface to the Hebrew Bible, and both of those beautiful essays are in his collection, No Passion Spent. He also wrote a book called Real Presences, in which he talks about the spirit in language. Well, this is what Steiner says about what happened to German during the Third Reich, to the language, not the people. He says, the language was infected not only with great bestialities, it was called upon to enforce innumerable falsehoods, to persuade the Germans that war was just and everywhere victorious. As defeat closed in, the lies thickened to a constant snowdrift. And then he goes on, languages have great reserves of life. They can absorb masses of hysteria, illiteracy, and cheapness. But there comes a breaking point. Use a language to conceive, organize, and justify Belsen. Use it to make out specifications for gas ovens. Use it to dehumanize man during 12 years of calculated bestiality. Something will happen to it. Something of the lies and sadism will settle in the marrow of the language, imperceptibly at first, like the poisons of radiation sifting silently into the bone. But the cancer will begin, and the deep-set destruction. The language will no longer grow and freshen. It will no longer perform quite as well as it used to. Its two principal functions, and I love this, the conveyance of humane order, which we call law, and the communication of the quick of the human spirit, which we call grace. I want to say that again. These are Steiner's notion of the two principal functions of language, the conveyance of humane order, which we call law, and the communication of the quick of the human spirit, which we call grace. And wasn't that what our conversation this morning was partly about? How the church needs to hold that relationship between law and grace, doctrine and ecumenical hospitality. So I think that idea that a living language balances itself on that point between the two is quite lovely. Steiner makes two other points worth mentioning in this regard. He says, as usable words are lost, shared experience becomes cruder and less communicable. And with the loss of subtlety, clarity, and reliability in language, the failure of the social contract we count on when we speak, we become more vulnerable to crude exercises of power. Now, it's easy to point our fingers at the German propaganda machine and think that we're fairly remote from it, but in fact, the applicability of Steiner's concern to the condition of American English right now are fairly obvious, I think. We don't have Hitler at the helm, but we do have tremendous forces that are co-opting language for special agendas. A lot of us have learned to accept being lied to, for instance. We know about newsmakers and their spin, and about the profiteering agendas of corporate advertising. And we've grown used to the flippant, ironic banter that passes for conversation on sitcoms, and used to hearing young people especially avoid positive claims by verbal backpedaling, the like that occurs two or three times in a sentence that blurs distinctions, and I think signifies a certain anxiety about making distinctions, and the whatever at the end of a sentence that neutralizes claims and forestalls arguments. I think rather than just kind of shaking our heads over those habits, it's really interesting to think about why they might be habits. And I think there is anxiety behind them and a certain nervousness about making positive claims, because there is a certain rootlessness in the culture in which they have learned to make those claims. Over the past couple of decades, we've heard political discourse that consists, and I'm not being partisan here, largely of euphemistic hedging, overgeneralization, accusation, hyperbole, broken promises, and lies or distortions, not to mention inanity and imprecision. Think about the kinds of language abuse we've become so accustomed to that they seem normal. One is thoughtless hyperbole that makes every new product the best ever, every new program really exciting, every child's effort, terrific. I've seen terrific on the top of a lot of grade school papers as our kids grew up. And also youth pastors somehow seem really particularly prone to hauling out the word exciting on every possible occasion. So I actually wrote a snarky little piece one time called Are We Excited Yet? I felt as though it might be helpful to remember that excitement used to be a pathological diagnosis. Read 19th century literature about excited nerves. Consider how words like wonderful or great or fantastic or incredible, which I see, maybe I see more of this than you because I read students' papers still all the time, but I don't know how many times I've written in the margins, incredible is an overused intensifier. See if you can find something else. And most regrettably, awesome. Think about how they've lost not only their precision and their impact, but lost something of the preciousness, especially a word like awesome, of their original and proper use. Another kind of language abuse that I think we've all become used to is unexamined metaphors that confuse important issues. The idea, for instance, of a corporation's workforce as a family, like the Walmart family, or the neutralizing description of war as a job. You know, if we're going to go to war, at least we need to understand what we talk about when we talk about war, and it's something more than a job to be done. Or speaking about education as a product, that one hits close to home for some of us. Or a vast anonymous population of consumers as a community, a life-giving word that I think we need to retrieve for better use. We've also become used to cliches and euphemisms that provide quick closure and substitute for thought. Public rhetoric is full of these false comforts that postpone urgent scrutiny of national policies by veiling the issues with reassuring phrases like land of the free, or the American way of life, or united we stand. We know this about political rhetoric, and it's not new, but a lot of it has been produced since 9/11. We've also become used to overgeneralizations and simplistic sentences that are driven by the soundbite and general blather that fills the airwaves, talk radio, talk shows, talk that passes for news analysis, more and more talk about less and less. Most of these practices are so embedded in current American discourse that we cease to think about their potential for harm. As we have normalized unsustainable levels of consumption, so we've also come to tolerate the dumbing down and the imprecision of public discourse without much complaint. I mean, really, when's the last time you heard a political debate that was a serious debate, at least in an election year? But much of what we call normal deserves serious critical scrutiny by people with the courage to point out that the emperor has no clothes. I think that would be us. So here's the challenge to educators and leaders of faith communities. We need to practice more intentional stewardship of words, and by that I mean we need to reclaim words that have been colonized and to honor the gift of language, remembering that it is a gift as precious as the earth that gives us food. Now here's a little good news. We have a whole lot to work with. Simply in terms of the number of available words, English is one of the richest languages in the world. And to point this out is, I hasten to say, not to devalue other languages. Every single one of them does something that English can't. So I know a linguist who likens the preservation of even dying language to preservation of species. Every loss depletes the ecosystem. Nevertheless, let's say what we have in English. English has over 1 million words today, and it keeps evolving. More than half of the world's technical and scientific periodicals and 3/4 of the world's mail are in English. About 80% of the information stored in the world's computers is in English. English is transmitted to more than 100 million people a day by the 5 largest broadcasting companies. I'm not saying it's good English or even useful English, but there it is. Because of the immense global influence of English, those of us who speak it have access to significant power and bear significant responsibility. The very scope of English makes it a ready instrument of empire, and it certainly has been. It bears within it the imperial history of Britain and America, which include highly developed discourses of justification for colonization and domination. These presumptions that are embedded in our speech can't be eradicated simply by legislation or policy, but need to be addressed at the level of language itself, revising the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves, the euphemisms in which we cloak our greed, the biases that favor the point of view of the privileged. But consider also these facts about Americans who speak English. And these are recent statistics. 14% of American adults are functionally illiterate, including at least 50% of the unemployed and 70% of those in prisons. And I would encourage you, as I give you these few statistics, to think about the implications for evangelization and the implications for the church and for how people hear Scripture and read Scripture and for the place of literacy in spiritual formation. Here are a few more statistics. The average kindergarten student has seen more than 5,000 hours of television, having spent more time in front of the TV than it takes to earn a bachelor's degree. And linguists have demonstrated a direct causal relationship between early television viewing and impaired literacy. And here's another one. 27% of Army enlistees can't read training manuals written at seventh grade level. A recent study of 21 to 25-year-olds showed that 80% of them couldn't read a bus schedule, 73% couldn't understand a newspaper story, and 63% couldn't follow written map directions. 44% of all American adults do not read one book in the course of a year. So to the extent that we are people whose faith is rooted in story and text, in word and sacrament, There is something about to be concerned about here for faith itself, because we do rely on words to teach people how to read and hear the word. So how do we repair this attrition? There are a lot of ways, and the remainder of the book after my first chapter, which is kind of my ain't it awful chapter, is a series of what I call stewardship strategies, ways that I thought might be practical strategies for conserving and caring for language. Just briefly, some of them are that we love words. I have a whole chapter called Love Words. We cultivate practices of reading discerningly and pausing over words and considering their implications. Occasionally we read poetry, gasp. We learn another language. We read not only contemporary writing, but antique texts like Shakespeare or Chaucer or the King James Bible to deepen our sense of words' resonance and their etymological layers of meaning. We engage in sustained conversation. We share stories. We pray not only our own prayers, but the Psalms and the great prayers of the church that have been crafted and preserved by saints who continue to nurture us with the images and the phrases and the sentences they left behind. So let me spend the remaining time just talking with you about a few of these strategies of stewardship. I don't have time to go through all of them. First of all is love words. My favorite scene in the 1987 movie Broadcast News, does anybody remember that? Is a moment when young Aaron, who has just graduated as valedictorian of his high school class, is attacked in the schoolyard after the ceremonies by two roughnecks whose object seems to be to humiliate him. And as they run off, Aaron picks himself up, and as he's considering how to deliver the unkindest cut he can, he hollers after them by way of revenge, "You'll never know the joy of writing a graceful sentence." I love that moment. That's the worst thing he can say to them. I think proper care of language begins in the joy he alludes to. Loving lines like Hopkins, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change for their theological vision. Or Mary Oliver's insistence that each pond with its blazing lilies is a prayer heard and answered lavishly. Or loving the Jacobean language of "He maketh me to lie down in green pastures," for the way it links us to generations of saints who have recognized poetry as a feature of worship. So our task as stewards of the word begins and ends in love. And let me just read you a little short passage from the chapter on loving words. One of the things I did in this chapter was go through, you know, love prepositions and love conjunctions and so on. I finally get to love nouns and love verbs, so I'm at the noun part here. And nouns, those instruments of Adam's power, all those Peterson's guides that give us the names of flora and fauna, the apples and balls and cats that launched us on our alphabetical way, the visual dictionaries that assure us that every screw and bolt and thingamajig has a legitimate name, reaffirm the solidity and stability and security we find in the names of persons and places and things. Deconstruction notwithstanding, we do rely on the relations between words and things. As Wendell Berry puts it in Standing by Words, quote, "The relation of speaker, word, and object must be conventional. The community must know what it is. We even affirm the goodness of young parents' freedom to name their children after trees or honeymoon resorts or rock stars because they've taken part in the work of creation, and the gift of naming is a reward. Mere lists of nouns can be poetry. Think, for example, of Hopkins' exuberant inventory of nouns in Pied Beauty. Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches' wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold, fallow, and plow, and all trades their gear and tackle and trim." Probably most of you know Hopkins. And when you look at this poem, one of the things you see is the exuberance of naming, just naming. He ends, of course, with that cry of praise for the one who fittingly fathers forth all this abundance of particulars. So we love nouns and the material blessings they bestow. But most of all, I want, before I leave this little chapter on loving words, to give thanks for verbs. We depend on them to reveal the dance of the whole dynamic universe, from orbiting electrons to sucking undertows to swiftly tilting planets. We entwine them in sentences like strands to describe the complex weave of events. A single verb can change our sense of what it is we're witnessing. As when Mary Oliver writes of praying vultures, quote, they minister to the grassy miles. Really, I will never see a vulture in the same way after hearing that line. They minister to the grassy miles. Good verbs invest our gestures with the language of the heart. Recall Frost, his line in After Apple Picking. There were 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. I love that line about with its precision about the task of apple picking, but I also love it as a metaphor for years of teaching. There are 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, and lift down and not let fall. And sometimes nouns become verbs because they can't sit still any longer. So things catapult and flame, and meetings are chaired. Verbs, I think, matter most. Asked for his name, God gave Moses a verb. And even those of us who are, as Cummings put it, human merely being, can't be contained in nouns, even buttressed by the best adjectives, but burst and blossom into verbs like Van Gogh's trees and leaping fields when we are most alive. I think I made this statistic up, but I generally tell students in writing classes that if you get more precise verbs, your writing will automatically be 33% better. And I hope that they remember that fake statistic because it's useful. But on that note, I'll say that the next chapter is on telling the truth, and that part of our job as stewards of language is clearly to tell the truth, which is really not simple. Emily Dickinson says, tell it slant, because truth must dazzle gradually or every man be blind. And so I think part of our task in telling the truth is to tell it judiciously and wisely and wittily and cleverly and in a timely fashion. There was something I read just the other day in The New Yorker. Someone was being quoted, I don't know if it was Kierkegaard, maybe someone knows, who said, we must tell what can be heard. We must not tell what cannot be heard. But that's such a good word for ministry. Flannery O'Connor said about telling the truth, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you odd. I love that, among many of her lines I love. Her quirky pronouncement has a certain prophetic force when we think of commonly accepted facsimiles of truth, from PR to advertising claims to propaganda masquerading as news. Simply the scale on which lies can be propagated can be overwhelming. So we need to recognize the practice of precision as a vigorous and challenging spiritual discipline. And I use that term intentionally, that the practice of precision in speaking and writing is a spiritual discipline. There is no question that precision is difficult to achieve. Imprecision is easier. Imprecision is available in a variety of attractive and user-friendly forms. Imprecision minimizes discomfort and creates a big, soft, hospitable place for all opinions. Even the completely vacuous can find a welcome there. Actually, when I have students who say everybody is entitled to their opinion, even just regarding the antecedent problem, I think, no, you're not. Not everybody's entitled to an opinion, not till you've done some homework. Not till you've kind of looked around and made sure that you have an opinion that's based on something. So the practice of precision not only requires attentiveness and effort, it may require the courage to hold people accountable and consequently tolerate their resentment. Precision begins with definition of terms. I asked a group of students recently to write down their working definitions of 5 terms whose imprecise usage poses a serious threat to peace and safety. And here are the terms: liberal, conservative, patriotic, terrorist, and Christian. All of these are very problematic terms these days. And there are people who use the term Christian that make me try to find ways not to use it. I mean, I teach at UC Berkeley. I don't know how much you know about Berkeley. It's another planet. And Christians are looked at with some suspicion by quite a number of people there. And when they hear the word Christian, they make a set of assumptions that I know don't fit. So speaking of knowing who you're speaking to, I generally, without failing to disclose my faith whenever I think it's appropriate, I also try to avoid the word when we're first out of the starting gate because it's so alienating. And I think, you know, I've done these little tests on words like liberal and conservative, and you know what hot potatoes those things are. Well, the results of my little tests with students are sobering in their range and banality. We witness abuses of these terms and the consequences of these abuses daily. But I want to say this about precision. It also requires, perhaps more significantly, attention to process. If I had to name my two or three most urgent goals in writing courses, one of them would be the precise verbs that clarify process. But it's hard to think clearly about process in an environment where most of us are surrounded with products we did not participate in planting or harvesting or designing or manufacturing or transporting or marketing. And indeed, the processes by which things come to us are often deliberately hidden so as not to draw attention to their less savory aspects like pollution or abusive labor practices or fuel consumption or toxicity or animal suffering or dislocation of local cultures. A precise use of the term cost would include all of the above. And I do think that if there's an objective to liberal education, helping students to think process is pretty close to the heart of it. Think how things came to be. Ask the how question. I think when we practice it, we find that precision is not only a form of responsibility, but also a pleasure and an instrument of compassion. To be precise requires care, time, attention to the person or the place or the process being described. And when we give that care and time and attention, we reap rich rewards. Let me read you just a little bit from the chapter on telling the truth. I put a list in here. I like lists. I think it's good to do lists whenever you can because it helps clarify the mind and it also keeps you going so that you discover things as you make them. So I made a list of characteristics of truth. I won't read all of them, but one is that truth is elusive. You have to find it. You have to go after it. Truth avoids institutional control. I don't know how many of you are familiar with, what was his name? The Sacred Canopy. It was a book about, it was by a sociologist about the history of the church, but it really was a history of institutional life where he talks about how institutions begin in epiphany and people gather around the epiphany, but unless they are very careful to keep being reformed and always reforming, as Luther put it, they tend to exfoliate to the point where they're expending most of their energies maintaining themselves rather than serving their original purposes. And I think that truth-telling is one of the casualties of that process. As institutions become very self-invested, the stories they tell themselves about themselves and their community life become somewhat rote, and truth gets lost. Truth tugs at conventional syntax. This is why we need poets. One of the things a poem does is disrupt the sentence long enough to help you see words in new chemical combinations and hear phrases before they grow up to become sentences or claims or pronouncements. Truth hovers at the edge of the visual field. And by this, I mean that there are many truths that can only be accessed in an epiphanic manner or intuitively. I just read a wonderful piece yesterday in preparation for a piece I'm writing about epiphanic knowledge as part of medical education and practice. But by epiphanic, I mean those things that you just get. They happen. The hunch, the sudden awareness, the thing that comes in from the edge of the visual field. And not to attend to that is to miss a significant part of clinical practice or a significant part of the relationship that we call ministry or teaching. Truth is relational. Father Tom addressed this a number of times last night and today, that truth is something I loved. There was a line I wrote down, that truth is an encounter. What a great line. And I love that Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the truth isn't the same as I tell the truth. He also said that. But to say I am the truth is a whole other dimension of understanding truth. Truth lives in the library and on the subway, which is to say that academic institutions and the church don't have a monopoly. And we also touched on that today. Truth is not two-sided, it's many-sided. I'm afraid I get obnoxious when people say, well, there are two sides to every question. I just can't help myself. I have to say, nope. There are at least 15, 16 sides to every question. Every question, maybe 360, you know. Dividing things into two sides, dividing things into debates, pro and con, is a dangerous business. Look at where we are now with a two-party system, Republican, Democrat. I think we could do better if we had a third party, if we knew how to reclaim the middle ground that is the gray area where we live anyway. And here's another part of my, if I ran the zoo, here's what I would organize liberal education around, not only attention to process, but also tolerance for ambiguity. John Keats, the poet, was the one who coined the term negative capability, by which he meant the capacity of the poetic mind to tolerate paradox or ambiguity without straining after resolution. Isn't that great? The capacity to tolerate ambiguity or paradox without straining after resolution. It isn't to say that we don't need to resolve some things and get to a declarative bottom line, but it is to say that if we can prolong that period of working with the possibilities of ways of putting it, working with the various points of view, we will end up with a richer claim at the end. Truth doesn't always test well. I'm just saying this for the educators in the audience. There's so much emphasis on testing now, and it leaves out so much in terms of particular styles of learning or seasons of maturing that we need to be particularly sensitive to in a test-happy educational climate. So, telling the truth. I also think that if I were ever called upon in a courtroom to swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, it would be really hard for me because I do not think that any one of us tells the whole truth. That's God's. We tell what we can. We see things from the vantage point we're given. We try to be faithful to that. And that's the best we can do, and that's why I think it's important to tolerate some ambiguity. Well, the next stewardship strategy after telling the truth is don't tolerate lies. And that's a hard one. I've already pointed out some of the ways in which we are commonly lied to. But it wouldn't be fair to cast blame without recognizing that we ourselves bear a heavy responsibility for allowing ourselves to be lied to. As Pascal pointed out before the age of media spin, we hate the truth and people hide it from us. We want to be flattered and people flatter us. We like being deceived and we are deceived. So here again, consider an analogy. If we purchase products whose processing or manufacture involves unethical use of resources or human labor, our participation is not ethically neutral. If we boycott or protest unjust practices, we may not stop the practices, but we add to what may become a critical mass of resistance and support the change we hope for. So that is to say, at least we need to be willing to have the conversation. Ask where the products came from. Ask if they were made in sweatshops. Ask who's the buyer. Whatever. I take that last word back. I was doing shorthand. This reasoning can be extended to language practices. When lies are tolerated, they erode the social contract that we count on for civil life together. To be safe and free, we need to hold ourselves and our leaders accountable for the words they speak. And insofar as we are able to clarify where there is confusion, to name where there is evasion, to correct where there is error, to fine-tune where there's imprecision, to change the terms when the terms falsify. I guess it might come down to, you shall know the truth and the truth shall make you obnoxious. But I do remember a wonderful woman, a deeply devout Catholic, by the way, whom I tremendously admired, was pretty famous locally for standing up at city council meetings, which she faithfully and knowledgeably attended, to say things to people like, excuse me, but that's hogwash. No, at least she broke open the conversation and somebody had to do it. So at least I think it's worth considering when it needs to be us and when to at least, with good humor and even grace, point out what is hogwash. I think I taught at Christian College for 12 years before going to Berkeley. That was going from one culture to another. But at the Christian College, one of the things I got a little tired of was everybody was so nice all the time. It was hard to generate a vigorous debate. So I actually wrote a little piece called Nice is Not the Point, which, you know, let that fall where it may. Let me read this bit from the chapter on Don't Tolerate Lies. Any effort to find reliable reporting needs to start not with questions about the sources, the reporter's sources, but questions about ourselves. And here are some. What are my responsibilities as a citizen, as a person of faith, as a consumer, as a leader, as a parent, as an educator? What am I avoiding knowing? By the way, I recently wrote a piece for I sent it to two magazines who have published many of my pieces. Neither of them took it. It was called What Are We Willing to Know? And it was just a challenge to people to consider, what are we not willing to know? Are we? I think why they didn't take the piece was I had a long list of things we may not be willing to know, and I guess they weren't willing to know them. But it's hard. It's hard to be willing to know things, especially the awful things. We go into overwhelm. That's understandable. But what am I avoiding knowing is kind of a good question. I remember a conversation with a very intelligent woman I admire and respect about vegetarianism and about some of the reasons to at least consider where your meat comes from and what happens in factory farms. And she ended up saying, la, 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 I don't want to hear it. I just want my meat. I thought, okay, we'll stop talking. But still, you know, it would be good to be willing to look at the factory farms and then decide where to buy your meat. So what point of view am I protecting? And why? And how have I arrived at my assumptions about what sources of information I rely on? What limits my angle of vision? Have I tried to imagine how one might arrive at a different conclusion instead of thinking, how could you think that? To shift the emphasis and just ask, how could you think that? Changes the whole conversation. How much evidence do I need to be convinced? And what do I accept as evidence? There's a lot of language in medicine and education about the culture of evidence. It doesn't appear to me that we live in a very reliable culture of evidence, but it's also interesting to consider, what do we take to be valid evidence? What kind of persuasion works most effectively for me? And how do I accredit or challenge my authorities? All these are useful questions, and I think it's good to start with the test questions for ourselves when we think about not tolerating lies and not simply to point the finger at the people Al Franken designates as lies and the lying liars who tell them, which is a book title. He put it right out there. Okay, here's another stewardship strategy. Read well. Learning to read is a lifelong process. What we learned in first grade or fifth or in our first encounter with Steinbeck or Spencer or the New York Times has layered and refined our sensibilities and strategies of reading. If we continue to seek out worthwhile writers, we find that each one of them has something to teach us about how to read. And in my chapter on reading, I spent quite some time talking about the practice of lectio. It is such a rich, wonderful, formative and informative practice, and I think that it can be exported from the reading and reflection on scripture to reading practices in daily life. To pause where it gives you pause. To ask yourself, where am I being addressed? What bothers me here? What awakens me? What touches me? Where do I have to go back? But just to be attentive to how we are being addressed, even when we read the New York Times. As we make our way through the world of print, we develop criteria of value and questions that equip us to read critically, open-heartedly, receptively, and resistantly. There are a lot of ways to read well. I think there's a tremendous emphasis in higher education right now on critical reading, and that's good. It's good to be a critical reader. It's also good to be a receptive reader. And I think especially within the church, it's important to learn how to read both intelligently and receptively. Those things are not at odds. Good reading involves moral attitudes. Good reading requires consent, permission, forgiveness. One of the questions I ask often in literature courses is, what do you have to forgive the writer in order to get the gift that's being offered? You might have to forgive Hemingway his anti-Semitism, or Eliot, or Shakespeare, for that matter. You might have to forgive Saul Bellow his patriarchalism, his paternalism. You might have to forgive a particular writer his or her stridency. But if you're looking for the gift that's being offered, as in a friendship, you find ways to move beyond that and to asking, what is the gift here and on what terms can I receive it? So good reading involves forgiveness. It involves resistance. And it involves compromise. Basically, when you start reading anything, the writer, whoever the writer may be, is saying, come with me. If you come, I will show you something you would not have seen this way unless you made this journey. But you have to take the journey on his or her terms to a certain point, and yet to remain resistant. How we choose to read, especially how we choose to read scripture, how we submit to or question or resist the terms set by the writer are choices that shape the habits of our minds and the habits of our hearts. And I'm not going to take time to read the passage from the chapter here, except to say that I developed these different metaphors for reading. One of them is to enter the text. When you read, you enter a space of habitation. Another is to eat the text. We use lots of language, for I just couldn't swallow that or stomach it, or I have to chew on this argument for a while, and so on. We use those metaphors routinely to talk about reading. We take it in. We take in the words. Another stewardship strategy for caring for words is to stay in conversation. And again, as with truth-telling, conversation is not simple. A colleague and I, a few years ago, tried a little experimental one-unit course called Conversational English for Native Speakers. We had 14 students. It was fun to try to retrieve the art of conversation that would go beyond kind of a few strokes and an ironic spin at the end. Good conversation is rare. To converse, originally among many other layers of meaning, meant to live among or together, or to act together, or to foster community, or to commune with, or to walk with. Those are all meanings that attach to the term converse. It's a large verb that has implied public, cooperative, and deliberate action. When we converse, we act together for a common end, and we act upon each other. Indeed, I think conversation is a form of activism, a political enterprise in the largest and oldest sense, and a way of building and sustaining community. Some years ago, when I first went to Westmont College, the Christian college I mentioned, the English department was in an old building. I love the fact that because they think all we need is pencils, they put English departments in the old buildings. But we had a big fireplace in a rather lovely living room. And the department gathered every Thursday afternoon for an hour to, get this, have tea and just talk to each other. It was an amazing experience in my academic life. That actually, sadly, was not sustained after several years. People got so busy, they all started eating lunch at their computers in their offices, and things fell apart, and the center did not hold. But still, I remember that practice of gathering for tea in a professional day as something that was so humane and so restorative. It really kept us in a place of congeniality, which is not altogether common in academic settings. A good conversationalist, if we're thinking about being a steward here, directs attention, inspires, corrects. I've used the word correct before. I think it's hard to be a person who corrects, but I had a wonderful grandmother who did that for me, and I've had some mentors along the way who are very good at generous, lovely, playful correction. And a good conversationalist empowers others. It may be that we don't often enough consider conversation as a form of social action or as a ministry or as a spiritual discipline. But the universal coupling of meals with conversation suggests the deep consonance that links those activities and that links them in what has been called the sacramentality of daily life. In conversation, we feed and are fed by one another. And I do want to read just a bit from the chapter on conversation. I can get to it quickly. I have observed that a quality of the best conversationalists conspicuously share is generosity. They can minister even to the most problematic partners, the inarticulate, the painfully introverted, and the indifferent. One sterling example of such generosity was a French professor who regularly sat at a dormitory lunch table where only French was to be spoken. Quite deliberately, I noticed, she chose the tables populated by students who were still struggling for basic mastery. Magically, she wove together shreds of sentences and picked up the dropped stitches of missing helping verbs, wrong tenses, and false cognates, working them into something resembling sprightly and civil discourse. I loved her for this. And she had a good time doing it. The range she achieved with very little help from her table companions was remarkable, from laughter over salt mistakenly passed to serious shared concerns about Americans in Vietnam and the rising costs of tuition. I still wonder whether she ever fully realized what a gift she imparted to those who were still among the lame, the halt, and the blind as far as spoken French was concerned. She is in my hall of heroes. Okay, quickly here, because I want some time for actual conversation. Here are some stewardship strategies I'm just going to skip through. One is to practice poetry and remember that poetry is a practice. I don't believe that we steward language well without regularly reading poetry and even writing it occasionally. There are good reasons not to engage in the practice of poetry. It is not profitable. I'm here to testify to that. There's a great deal of bad poetry out there that's really a waste of time, and you have to wade through some of that to find the good poetry. And reading and writing poetry require quality time that for most of us is a limited commodity. But poems help us. They demand that we slow down, that we notice patterns, that we reckon with ambiguities, that we consider the subtle distinctions between one term or image and its alternative, and that we recognize the relationship between techniques and purposes. If we take this work on, good poems can equip us to walk into any situation and look around and assess and analyze and act. And more than that, they restore to us what the noise and haste of commercial culture dulls and destroys: deliberation, delight, contemplation. Just listen to this very short poem by Ted Olson. Not that you need a testimony to the value of poetry, but it's a short poem like many that is surprising. One of the functions of a good poem is to surprise us into awareness that gets dulled. This was a poem about a hawk. It's called Hawk. This was the perilous, lovely way the hawk fell down the long hill of the wind, the anarch air shaped by his going, air become visible, bent to a blade of beauty, cruel and taut and bare, a bow of ecstasy, singing and insolent. Well, like Mary Oliver and her vultures, you know, I will never look at a hawk the same way again, having read Olson's poem. So I think practicing poetry helps us to do that work of seeking precision, allowing ourselves to be surprised, and experiencing the renewal that reminds us that the world is charged with the grandeur of God. There's a great essay by Howard Nemiroff called On the Similarity Between Poems and Jokes. I think the main title is Bottom's Dream, On the Similarity Between Poems and Jokes. And he talks about what happens in the punchline of a joke, which is that a sudden radical reframing takes place where the logic changes. And that a good poem does that too, to surprise you out of your sleepiness, your conventionalities, your cliches, into thinking again about something you thought you knew. The last three chapters in the book and the last three strategies of stewardship are to play, to pray, and to cherish silence. Playfulness, it seems to me, is the mark of an open heart. It's the mark of the presence of the Spirit. The most spiritually alive people I have known are also playful people. It doesn't mean that they're funny, but it does mean that they live in the moment, they see the possibilities, they appreciate the surprise, they try things out. Playing with words, I think, is an indispensable way of learning to love them and use them with wit and skill. To play is to claim our freedom as beloved children of God and to perform our tasks with invention and exuberance. It's to be free to experiment and fail, free to find out and reconsider, free to say something we might need to take back, free to look stupid in the interests of honesty. Children who feel safe and loved are playful. And I think what we need to model for the world as people of faith is that we are children who are safe and loved. We are completely safe and loved, no matter what is going on in the world. It's a large view of safety, and it's a large kind of love. To play is to live in grace. And to live in grace is not to ignore the law. There has to be a lucid thesis sentence, and comma splices must be rooted out. But to embrace what is law as an invitation to abundant life. Good stewards play. And pray. It's a funny thing to put in here as a stewardship strategy. But in his beautiful reflection on language and story, which I've mentioned, Real Presences, George Steiner claims that close work with words inevitably brings us into encounter with the divine. That's a large claim, and I think it's true. This extravagant claim takes a high view of language as a gift from God, fitted to the tasks God assigns us. Steiner reminds us of the great silence behind speech, the ways in which all language emerges from and returns to a silence that is full, not empty. The language of prayer does not break that silence, but inhabits it. Prayer is where words return to their original and most profound purpose. The language of prayer brings our intentions into sharp focus. It engenders intimacy with God. It brings us into alignment with the other members of the body of Christ. And Jesus taught us to pray with words. So even though the Spirit can pray within us with sighs too deep for words, he invited us to pray with words. And I think we will do the best we can, and we must, with that, and then God will make them worthy. And the last strategy is just to cherish silence. We don't get much of it in this culture. Eliot writes, "Words after speech reach into the silence. When they're lifted out of the babble that surrounds them, they yield unforeseen gifts." As Bonhoeffer wrote, "Meditation is not having great thoughts, but loving the words you hear and letting them shape you." Which, of course, takes us, I think, back to Lectio. Some of us may go for days, sometimes for months, without significant silence, but eventually, I think, we begin to hear even our own words as babble. Without silence, language becomes noise. And in the electronic jungle our children inhabit, background noise is not only a fact of life, but an addiction. And I use that term advisedly. We need the challenge and the healing of silence in our lives. The best of our artists and ministers offer it, finding inventive ways to open up interior spaces, weaving respectful words around what cannot be said, protecting sacred silences with chant or plain song or the ding of a chime so that we can find in it a place to lie down in green pastures and be restored. It is hard to provide silence for people. Silences so quickly become uncomfortable, but I think that's part of our work. So now I think I'll let my own words stop and just ask you in the remaining few minutes to offer any observations you have about the ministry of language and the stewardship of language, or questions if you have them. Yes.
When I was taking yoga practice, yoga meditation, etc., haven't done it actively lately, the yogis taught us that the greatest source of pollution in the earth is noise, our own human-created noise pollution.
Mm-hmm. And the second thought I wanted to share with you is a question, whether in your examination of speech and writing and precision, you have read the book written by a woman in California whose name I've forgotten, who's on television out in California. It's called Kill the Messenger, I believe, and it explores in her book how the German propaganda machine developed by Hermann Göring was used in the genocide acts in Africa and in the genocide acts against the Jews, and is in fact now used by Fox News Network, which is owned by the fellow out of England whose name escapes
Murdoch?
Me. Murdoch.
Is that a Murdoch?
And you see him buying more and more media outlets, and he's infusing that with his point of view, which engenders hatred, engenders suspicion, and is destructive to our society. I thought if you could comment on those points.
Yeah, I think that these propaganda techniques get passed along. Of course, many of them are not new. And in fact, one thing I read from a reliable source I can't now name because I don't remember was that Hitler actually took some of his program from reading Andrew Jackson's proposals for ways to get the Indians off their land. And so American genocide was one of the sources of German genocide, which is now becoming another source of perpetuating this violence on whole populations and the hate speech. And so, yes, I think that's true. And in fact, if you're interested, it's not my point just to stand up here and trash Fox News, but it is an easy target. There is a website, I think it's still up there. If you Google 32 reasons not to watch Fox News, it just goes systematically through the journalistic code of ethics that is a sort of universal journalistic code of ethics and provides multiple instances for the ways Fox News has violated every one of them. And so, there's a place where I'm just not going to be so polite as not to name a particular outlet that I think is really violating public trust. But I think you raise an important point that these techniques are persistent. They're like crabgrass, and they spread, and they grow, and they get reappropriated by and domesticated by institutional bodies that we like to think of as normal and benevolent even. Yeah, thank you for that.
You're talking about words, and I was thinking with staying in the connection, and I teach freshman English and with high schoolers, and what do you think?
Bless you.
What do you think texting and Facebook posting and Twitter, where you can only post in so many characters, and especially texting, what do you think that's doing to the staying in conversation and that stewardship of words, where they don't know how to use words and they don't know that face-to-face conversation anymore?
Yeah. Well, I think that texting, the most obvious answer, I think, is that they live in a culture of abbreviation. And I have certainly noticed, and I bet you have too, that their communications become more quick and clipped and, get to the bottom line, get on with it. So it is hard for them to sustain attention. Neurologists, I do work in a medical school and occasionally read pieces by neurologists about what the incessant electronic engagement is doing to their brains. And someone used the term, and I don't think it's just a metaphor, that these devices are extensions of their nervous systems. So to say that we are stewards of language and ministers of the word is to say that it's a ministry of healing. And to enable students in a classroom to look at one another, put the phones away, to wait for them to answer in a complete sentence. I remember saying to a student one time who was just constantly, you know, speaking in quick phrases, and it was kind of like, you know, and every sentence ended with an ellipsis. And I finally said, "Cece, we're all going to wait here until you think about the sentence that you want to say. And it's okay, we're just going to wait." But I didn't mean to embarrass her, and I knew her well enough to think that would be okay. But I think these poor kids, you know, they're locked into a system of communication that's incessant and rapid and a little bit threatening. Well, a lot threatening if you think about Instagrams and what's being passed around on those. So just to enable them to slow down is to help them toward a kind of countercultural posture, and that's a huge challenge. So I think part of my answer would be just not to underestimate the challenge of slowing down. They're hurting.
Marilyn, thank you. It's a wonderful talk.
Thanks.
I think what you've said is great preparation for reading Laudato Si. So much of what you said is reflected in that document. I wonder if you could comment also on one of the things that I think is really insidious in our religious communities, and that is a fundamentalism, where we take the scriptures, we cannot understand metaphor, we cannot understand story, we take it to be literally true. And it's so pervasive in our society.
And it's so dangerous.
And so dangerous.
I have a lot to say about that. I'll try not to say most of it. But I do think that fundamentalism of any kind, you know, look at the fundamentalists in any tradition. They're scary people. Literally, actually, the man who was just before this president of Princeton Seminary, Ian Torrance, was a Scot. And when they first inaugurated him as president, a reporter went up to him and said, "Well, as a Scot coming to teach in an American seminary, I wonder if you would say what you think is the main problem that's facing the American church." And he had a one-word answer, and it was literalism. And I thought it was a really good answer. So part of the ministry of the word is in pulpits and in classrooms and in conversation and in Bible studies or wherever we have the chance to remind people that what we're looking at here is poetry, and over here it's prophecy, and over here it's apocalyptic literature, and over here it's various forms of biography written for different audiences. And that isn't to say that it isn't a sacred text or the word of the Lord, but it is to say that God speaks in many modes through many devices. And to lose that is to become legalistic, to engage in what some have called bibliolatry, and to use the Bible as a bludgeon. And I think it's one of the most frightening things happening now. So I do think literalism is one of the things all of us need to challenge. Just in the way I said, you know, don't accept being lied to, fundamentalism of that kind, or literalism, is a way of being lied to. So we need to be the one to rise up and say, "No, it isn't." No, wait, this is a poem. And here were some conventions of poems when the psalmist was writing. And the stones, you know, the mountains didn't then probably clap their hands. So let's just talk about metaphor. Yeah. And also metaphor is just such a, it's inevitable. And not to recognize it is a kind of stupidity. And here I want to say a kind word for Calvin, which one doesn't hear very often. But one of my favorite things that John Calvin said was that stupidity was a sin. So I like that. I think we need to stop because there is the funeral mass at 3:30 for any of you who want to go. So thank you so much, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
Thank you, Marilyn. Marilyn will...